Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Okay, I'm going to take a big leap here. Just as the single names of Cher, Britney, and Madonna can strike a chord in each of us and you pick your own chord, so do the names of contagious diseases, even those that most of us believe are no longer a threat, yellow fever, smallpox, bubonic plague. That is how strong the impact of disease has been on human history and our psyche. Dr. Michael Oldstone has written about the politics and impact of the world's most notorious diseases in viruses, plagues, and history, past, present, and future. Dr. Oldstone is a virologist and professor at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. He's with us today to talk about the book, The Past, Present, and Future. Welcome, Dr. Oldstone.
Thank you, Ann.
How did you like that link with Britney, Madonna, and Cher? Because that's how I feel about diseases sometimes. They seem sort of iconic to me, but not really real.
Well, I would have thought those three names should bring some joy and entertainment, and these diseases don't do that.
Okay, that's the difference, the happiness factor. You said in your book that you fashioned the book after the book Microbe Hunters by Paul DeCruyff or Criff. You read that book in junior high. How do the books resemble each other? And I know that the first edition of this book came out in 1998, of your book.
Right.
But how are they similar?
Well, Paul DeCruyff wrote a book in the 20s about the heroes that formed microbiology, Louis Pasteur, Robert Koch, etc. And I read that book when I was in junior high school, and it made a lasting impression on me, and I decided that's what I'd like to spend my life doing. Indeed, a lot of people in my generation and earlier generations who read that book went into medicine because of that book. And I thought that I would like to write a book that would bring up to date what DeCruyff did, but though talking about people who influenced and discovered and did different things about diseases, I thought I'd write about how diseases affected human history and affected migrations of people and the politics and what went on. And I did write the book to try to induce or seduce people to go into investigative research or medicine. So that's the link with Paul DeCruyff.
Yeah, the idea of how diseases have affected or impacted human history, it was very interesting. And I learned that bioterrorism didn't start a few decades ago. It's been around for a long time, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But you tell 12 stories, right, about the success and the failure in controlling infectious diseases. But H1N1, the swine flu that we're engrossed with right now, isn't among them. But could it have been? Is it, you refer to it at the very end briefly?
Well, when I had written the book and I had finished the book and we were in galleys, the swine flu broke out. And so I wrote a short part about the swine flu, but you're right, not a chapter about it. At that time, we didn't know what the denominator was. That was how many people were being exposed and what the consequences are. As a matter of fact, Ann, we still don't know that information. We do know that a lot of people have died from it, and a lot of young people have died from it, and we can make some benefit-risk assessments about what the worst scenario is and what one should really do about that type of disease.
Over time, who has died from the diseases have affected a lot of things, and I think a lot of more people maybe are paying attention to H1N1 because it affects younger people so much, and that surprises us that a 14-year-old boy could die of a flu in an otherwise healthy child. That seems what's different about it, and why we're paying so much more attention. But H1N1 isn't necessarily, we don't know the ultimate denominator, as you said, but we do know that as it stands right now, it's not necessarily killing or ailing many more people than what we think of as the regular seasonal flu, right?
Well, we don't, yes, but the this is the issue. The issue is that H1N1, not this variety, but another variety of H1N1, came through in 1918, 1919. Right. At that time, it killed 50 million people. That's an awful lot of people to die. It was about 2 to 3% of the world's population. And to put it in perspective, in the United States, about one-third of all physicians died, about 75% of all nurses were hospitalized, and in cities like Philadelphia, they ran out of coffins and buried people in pits. And that was in 1918, 1919. There were more casualties from influenza in 1918-1919, the H1N1, which we called Spanish flu, from influenza than there were from shrapnel and bullets and gas. So, you know, it's not something that one wants to wait for later statistics, I don't think.
Throughout the book, from the very beginning, you talk about this common thread of fear, superstition, and irrational behavior that ran through all the stories. There's really never been anything that anyone who's tried to address the threat of disease who hasn't been ridiculed in some quarter, it appears. Have the objections changed over time, or are they pretty much the same thing as they were back in the 16th century?
Well, a lot of them are the same. So, as an example, when yellow fever was in the United States, and it went up and down the Mississippi Valley and devastated people in the Mississippi Valley. In fact, it killed about half the population of Memphis in the mid-1870s. People put up barricades to prevent people from going into their territory. They stopped trains going into Memphis. And, of course, the disease is not spread. A person doesn't spread it to a person. It's spread from a mosquito that bites a person. The mosquito then bites another person. So it was irrational. But then when polio broke out in New York City, for example, in the 1900s, about early part of or the mid part of the 1900s in New York City, a place is blockaded, trains going out of New York City, and so that, for example, in New Jersey, they stopped passengers from going to New York. And then, if you go to the recently, let's say in 2006 or 7, when Ebola breaks out in Africa, people put up barricades to prevent people from going into their territory. So it's the same type of the unknown, not sure what to do, and the emotionality that occurs with it.
I, just in my own reading, have never found a lot of fiction or historical fiction regarding, say, the influenza of 1918-1919. But I did read a book a couple years ago. It was called The Last Town on Earth. And it was a very remote town up in, I think, Washington State or Oregon or something like that, that decided to blockade and not let people within, I think, like a 5-mile range of the town. Of course, you know, within a few weeks, practically everybody was dead anyways. But you don't see a lot of dramatization. It's sort of like we don't really know a lot about what really happens when there's a big outbreak of disease, contagious disease. We only know it in theory now in our generation.
Yes. One thing, Anne, that one should point out, and I try to do it in my book, Viruses, Plagues, and History, is that we now are living, because of our success, with no real knowledge of these devastating diseases. When I was growing up, and there was a case of polio, my parents were scared. I mean, that I would get poliomyelitis. Polio was a disease affecting children throughout the United States, and there was a massive campaign by mothers. The March of Dimes, in fact, started by mothers in Arizona to fight poliomyelitis. So that as a parent, you would look and you'd see children that were stricken, you'd see children that died, or children that were paralyzed. And since the 1950s, the amount of vaccines that have been developed that have protected against the polio and against measles, which used to send thousands of children to mental institutions for the rest of their lives, you don't see that anymore. So that we take for granted the health that we have. And then when something comes up, people say, well, I don't see anybody who's sick. Why should I do anything about it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the problems.
My only real memory as a child growing up was when I had to take a sugar cube. It was in the 60s, the early 60s. We took a sugar cube for something. Do you know what that was?
No.
We were scared to death. I mean, of course, the sugar. And the point was they gave us sugar cubes because that's what kids would take. I don't remember what the problem was. You assert...
Well, the sugar cubes were given for polio.
Polio. Okay.
Polio vaccine.
Okay. You make a point in the book to say that the most important benefit of controlling infectious disease is the alleviation of pain and suffering, obviously. But what are the other benefits? Since we've been so successful at it, all things being equal, what are the other benefits to us to participate in controlling these kind of diseases if it doesn't affect us personally?
Well, let me give you an example. When poliomyelitis was a problem in the United States, the money it cost to treat patients in the Sister Kenny Hospital for 1 year in the 1950s equaled the entire amount of money spent by the government and private foundations for research to conquer polio. Now, if you take the numbers of people who have polio, who are put out of the work marketplace because they have polio, who require constant care either because they're in iron lungs or assisted respirations, you know, who don't die. I mean, dying would be the worst, but who don't die from the disease, but who are incapacitated and can't work, and we take care of us as a society. I mean, the cost is astronomical. So that, you know, for you could say that for each dollar that one puts in to cure or to fight these various diseases, the return is, you know, is a hundredfold or more in terms of not having to take care of people in chronic hospitals, et cetera.
When was it that humans made the connection between these viruses and their health? There was a time when it was just considered God's will that they were uncontrollable.
Sure. Well, you know, virus infections have been reported since the time of Hippocrates. I mean, rabies was reported. They described it. They did not know it was a virus. But the first viruses that were found to be viruses occurred just before the beginning of the 1900s. So it was about 1898 that the first viruses were isolated. And the story goes as follows. In the 1840s, when people were looking at what was the cause of infections, and these were bacterial infections, and led by Louis Pasteur, they developed a filter, and if you had a infection, they took the material that was infected and they put it on the filter, and they used some pressure to drive it through the filter, and the material stuck to the filter because it was large. These were bacteria. Then they could look under the microscope and they could see that they were bacteria. And then if they inoculated that bacteria back into the source that they got it from or into an animal, they could recapitulate the disease. So those were bacteria. And that was done in the mid-1840s. And then around 1898, with two diseases, tobacco mosaic virus and one of plants, and then of animals, it was foot and mouth disease, they put the material in and it passed through the filter because it was so small, number one. It passed to the bottom. They couldn't see it because it was so small. They couldn't see it by a microscope. And at that time, there wasn't tissue culture, so you couldn't grow it because bacteria grow in agar, and viruses need living cells to grow in. So the early pioneers who first isolated viruses were stuck with something they couldn't see that was small enough to pass through a filter and couldn't be grown on in agar. So those were the first viruses that were picked up. Indeed, flu wasn't picked up as a virus until the 1930s.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have to take a short break. I am speaking with Dr. Michael Oldstone. He is the author of Viruses, Plagues, and History. He wrote the book first in 1998. It has been updated. It came out about a week and a half ago, and it talks about the impact of diseases on history, on the history of humans. If you would like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Laura O'Toole explains to older job seekers that finding a job has now gone high tech, but some of the job hunters haven't done it this way before.
What about the old-fashioned way, about, you know, going to the premises and filling out an application?
That's why thousands of unemployed people are turning to the library for assistance.
Hear the latest in local and national news with Morning Edition on WOSU 89.7 FM.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. It's your choice with the WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Go to wosu.org/email to sign up. Currently 51 degrees in downtown Columbus, and now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am speaking with Dr. Michael Oldstone. He is the author of Viruses, Plagues, and History. It's a book about how disease has affected the history of humans. And it has many, many times, maybe more so back when it was uncontrolled, but that could happen again, and that's part of why we're talking about it. Dr. Oldstone, to prevent viruses from spreading, you say that we need to make the population risk immune, and that's called the herd immunity. Why do we call it that? Well, how does that work?
Well, to stop a virus from circulating within a group, you need to provide protection for the vast majority of people within that group. And if, for example, the control, let's say in Columbus, Ohio, against measles virus is that about 90% of people are vaccinated, then the chances of measles virus, or greater than 90%, the chances of measles virus spreading in Columbus is practically zero. If you fall down to 80%, then you have enough susceptible people in the population that that you can now spread measles virus through the population. And so, of course, since you don't vaccinate babies and things like that, you put your neighbors' children and things like that at risk.
So that means when people say that they don't get the flu vaccine because they never get the flu, they don't need it. They never get the flu. They're kind of missing the point there.
Yes, they would be, of course, the people who would then have become susceptible to the flu, and if they got influenza, they would spread it on to their neighbors, of course.
You know, one of the shocking moments in the book for me was, when you're talking about man's inhumanity to man, was in the case of Jeffrey Amherst. He was a British commander in chief in North America. I think it was well before the Revolutionary War. I might be wrong about that. I should put the date down. But he handed out blankets to the Native Americans knowing that they were infected with smallpox or that they could spread smallpox. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is correct. So that as he purposely, and it was done purposely by the English, to give blankets with smallpox to the Indians. They're around in the north east around the Detroit area, and they gave these pockets of these blankets, and they decimated the Indian tribes. But you know, the English also sent during the Continental Army during our Revolution, when Washington was on the heights overlooking Boston, the British also sent people who were inoculated with smallpox and incubating it to surrender into American lines to also spread smallpox. And that's why Washington did a procedure called variolation, where he variolated the entire Continental Army because of that.
Yeah, variolation's an interesting thing. Could you describe the difference between that and inoculation?
Sure. The variolation was known since the 3rd or the 4th century, started in Asia, we think in India or in China. And what people did was, if you had smallpox, they would take the smallpox material, the lesion from the smallpox, and they either would dry it up or they would just pass it onto somebody else. So it would inoculate you with living smallpox. So if you're susceptible and you get smallpox, approximately one-third of the people getting smallpox will die. If you variolate, that is, take the pus from a smallpox lesion and inoculate it into people, about 3% of the people who get that will die. And then following that, we had vaccination, which is done by Edward Jenner in England, which he found that a virus isolated from cows called cowpox could also cross-protect against smallpox. And then there, it's about 1 in 500,000 who will die from that type of inoculation. So that's the difference between the wild-type disease, the variolation, and vaccination. But, Anne, you know, your listeners might be interested in knowing that the Spanish conquered the Americas with very few people because of the spread of smallpox wiped out the Native Americans. It was a matter of 800 people versus 2 million in a fight, and the Indians had never seen smallpox. Smallpox had been in Europe, so it was brought by the Spanish inadvertently.
Right. They didn't. That was not intended.
Not intended, and devastated them. And because of that, because the Spanish, of course, had the Trinity and marched into battle carrying the cross, and the Indians had their own gods, it was viewed by the Indians as Western gods, the Christian gods, were superior to their mm-hmm. god. And that led to predominantly to the conversion of so many Indians. And then to follow that up, because so many Indians had been lost, Native Americans had been lost, the Spanish needed other workers to work their mines and exploit the Americas. And so that was the beginning of the slave trade of bringing blacks from Africa. Was all related to devastation from smallpox.
And to follow up on that, yellow fever was a big reason why they were brought over to the North America, because they weren't as susceptible to that either, right?
Right. And when the Africans came over, they brought over yellow fever, which had never been in the Americas before. Mm-hmm. And yellow fever's devastated the Spanish and especially the French, who had a colonial empire in the New World, and that led Napoleon to give the Louisiana Purchase, sell the Louisiana Purchase to Jefferson. So that, if you think about just American history, I mean, in terms of a conversion to Christianity, into import of Africans as slaves, and into Louisiana Purchase, that's all related to smallpox and yellow fever.
Absolutely. I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Oldstone. He has written the book Viruses, Plagues, and History. If you would like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Jeannie. What is the current state of prevention for Ebola? How prevalent is Ebola? These are several questions, Jeannie, but I'll read them anyway. What are the chances of someone with Ebola getting on a plane in Africa, infecting those on board, and those victims exiting a plane and spreading it here in the U.S.? Is that possible? So I guess she's asking something like Ebola, how easy is it to spread? And what's the update on that now?
Well, Jeannie, those are very good questions. And in fact, the spread of these hemorrhagic fevers, Ebola and Lassa fever, coming from a limited place in Africa to the United States or to other parts of Europe is quite good. And there have been cases in which it has occurred, in which people get infected, incubate the disease, so they don't show the disease, but the virus is incubating in them, get on a plane, travel to London or to Germany, and in one case travel to Chicago, and then come down with the disease. So yes, those are possibilities, and those in fact have occurred, and they're quite frightening as the world gets smaller. As far as treatment for Ebola, there is no treatment present for Ebola or for the other hemorrhagic fevers like Lassa fever virus, which kills many more people than Ebola. Lassa killing about 15,000 people per year in Africa and infecting about 200,000. But Ebola, when it occurs, some of the strains can kill up to 90% of the people it infects. We know a little bit about Ebola. We know about its genomic organization. We know how it spread through bats, but there's no vaccine yet for it. But the National Institutes of Health and other agencies are working hard to develop a vaccine against these hemorrhagic fevers. But you're absolutely right. By transportation, it can occur in the United States.
There are treatments for people who have the flu. There's Tamiflu. I guess there are other sorts of medications you can take to address the symptoms of the flu. And there was a letter to the editor in the Columbus Dispatch this morning, Dr. Oldstone, that talked about that and also mentioned the issue of why don't we just treat people who get the flu and avoid the dangers and the risks of the vaccination. And there is a caller on the line right now, a physician. I think, Janet, you're a physician?
No. Okay. I'm calling about that very letter, which alarmed me because the start of the letter says how dangerous it will be to use the widespread vaccination for H1N1. It'll cause autism. And I was actually quite disturbed by that letter. I wonder what your physician thinks of that.
Well, Janet, before we go to that, though, I'm interested, too, but will you get the H1N1 vaccination if it becomes available to you?
Yes, and my son, who's at Bexley High School, will be vaccinated by the county. His Board of Health is vaccinating students whose parents give permission.
Okay.
For it.
All righty. Dr. Oldstone, what about that?
Let me address the two questions.
Sure.
First, you asked about the Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the virus, as viruses change as they're challenged by an antiviral drug, and so we now know that a number of these viruses have become resistant to Tamiflu. So by treating haphazardly a whole population with Tamiflu, what will happen is that you will result in the drug not being useful for the majority of people. So that'll be a problem. And second thing, as far as the vaccine is concerned, I mean, I think it's foolhardy not to get the vaccine. When you look at any kind of vaccine or any kind of medicine or anything you do, there's a benefit risk ratio, and the risks from the vaccine are very, very small, and the benefits are enormous. I would say that if you were around when they had the last H1N1 outbreak, which was in the 1970s, 76, 77, and you had flu, then you have a partial protection against it. But if you're younger than that, then you'd have really no protection for swine flu, a very minimal protection. So, I mean, I would think that if you just look at the odds. Now, I understand the argument that if something bad happens and it happened to you, then the odds are 100% because it's you. But
right.
When you look at a large population, the risks are so small and the benefits are so great. You really should take the vaccine.
You know, the issue of autism has come up many times. I've heard it in conjunction with the measles vaccine, I think, maybe the chickenpox, but it's pretty common. What do you know about that?
Well, I know a great deal about it. And you know, autism is a very sad disease to see in one's children. And so there are two aspects of it that I'd like to discuss with you. The first thing, when autism was first described, which was at the end of the Second World War by a psychiatrist in Austria and one in the United States, it was related to what we would call a type A family, in which both the mother and the father were working. Okay? And so the implication was that this was related to parents who weren't taking care of their children and bringing them up, because a lot of women were not working in the 1940s professionally. Well, we know that's not the case, but that stigma came on, and so when these societies formed, it was a matter of saying, you know, we're not responsible for what's gone on, and then you relate it to different kinds of vaccine. A very spurious article came out in Lancet that put the relationship between autism and measles virus. That was later retracted by the authors, and the journal wrote an apologetic piece, and it turned out that the authors had been paid by lawyers who were then suing the vaccine companies. So it was terrible, and that led to measles vaccine not being taken in England and in Ireland, and then it led to an outbreak of measles, and it led to children being hospitalized, and some being hospitalized for the rest of their lives because of mental retardation. So that was just a terrible, terrible thing. Now, in terms of the cause of autism, we now know that the predominant cause is genetic, that a cluster of genes have been determined to be involved, and studies, very comprehensive studies, looking to see whether vaccine caused it or whether materials in the vaccine caused it, have now been done, and the answer is that those are not the cause of autism. Now, to me, you know, if you had an open question, you decide yes or no, and you find out that it's not the cause of it, then you say, good, that we can move on to really find out what the cause is and how to prevent it. But it's such an emotional issue, you know, if for example, one says it's genetic and, you know, your child has it. That's an emotional issue.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Michael Oldstone. He wrote the book Viruses, Plagues, and History. The thesis, plagues, viruses, they have had a major impact on our history. It's been very interesting. If you would like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a quick break right now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter David Rode tells us about being kidnapped by the Taliban on his way to interviewing a Taliban commander.
Several men came rushing towards our car with Kalashnikov assault rifles. It was clear that it had sort of been a well-planned ambush.
Rode escaped in June after 7 months in captivity. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jarovich, 52 degrees in downtown Columbus. Get access to WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen anywhere in the world by streaming on the web. Hear the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your own computer. Listen online at WOSU.org. In the weather forecast for today, some sunshine this morning and then clouds move in this afternoon, bringing a very slight chance of afternoon rain, a high of 65. Rain showers are likely tonight, a low of 48 degrees. Mostly cloudy Wednesday morning with morning rain showers and a high of 60 for Wednesday. Currently 52 degrees in downtown Columbus, and now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Oldstone. He wrote the book Viruses, Plagues, and History. It's about how disease has affected the course of history and humankind. Dr. Oldstone, about the same time as Jeffrey Amherst let loose the blankets among the Indians, John Winthrop, the Massachusetts Bay Company governor, wrote in his diary, he said, "They are all dead of the smallpox, so the Lord cleareth our title to what we possess." There was another sort of reference to God in the 18th century. The British embassy chaplain was raging that the variolation at that time was unchristian and it would only succeed in infidels. And I was thinking, wow, talk about setting people up for failure. If you survive, then that means you're an infidel. And really, the last time I've heard a lot of talk about the notion of God involvement regarding disease was, of course, with AIDS. Where does that come from? Is that, again, just another emotional issue? It doesn't seem rational.
Well, it's very complex. When they the only infectious disease that's been eradicated has been smallpox. And when they tried, the World Health Organization was eradicating smallpox, they had some problems in some countries, let's say like India, where there's a goddess of smallpox that's worshipped as the goddess of smallpox. And so you have these cults that that have arisen, and they've arisen, you know, with people have, I guess you would say, they're cultural. There may be a lack of knowledge at that period of time. So in India, there was a goddess of smallpox, and you prayed to that goddess, of course, that your child didn't get smallpox, and you gave offerings to that, and it was felt that you would insult that god if you tried to vaccinate to prevent smallpox. So Indira Gandhi and others, it took a lot of political persuasion to get smallpox coverage in some countries.
Well, kind of.
And indeed, I should tell you that there were problems with poliomyelitis, and to try to prevent poliomyelitis in northern Nigeria, some areas, Muslims in that area, said that the vaccine was a Western plot to sterilize females, and therefore the vaccine against polio shouldn't be given. And for a period of time, they prevented that. And when there was the Hajib traveling to the Muslim Holy Lands, the pilgrimage to Mecca, et cetera, and pilgrims passed through Nigeria, they managed to re-spread poliomyelitis through Africa and back to Indonesia and other countries. So thankfully, that's prevented. But those kinds of things, you know, where people have said, this Jews are poisoning our wells, that's why you have this disease, or that, or the Western countries are. Giving a vaccine to make our women fertilized to drive out Muslims. There's a Christian plot. I mean, it sounds really irrational, and I guess it is. But those things really happen, and they've happened as recently as a few years ago.
With AIDS, of course, it was further demonized because it affected so many people in the United States who were gay, and some people say, and it's pretty well known, that maybe research into the cause of AIDS and HIV was delayed and has been slower than it would have been because of that.
I think that is true when it was demonized, but now we know a great deal about AIDS. We know, for example, that it occurred in Africa and it occurred in the 1930s. That it probably was spread by hunters who killed apes and chimpanzees who were went into the jungle in territories that people hadn't been experienced to. When they butchered those animals for food, that are contaminated by blood, and it's been spread from that point on. But you know, that should be a wake up call to a lot of people. Just think about it: no AIDS before 1930. Hunters getting it in Africa, and then spread to the world. So there are, 36 million cases of AIDS, and about half of them have already died. You know, we now have drugs that prevent people from dying if you can get them the drugs, which you can in most Western countries, so you can live a normal life and probably die from heart disease or other types of things. If you can afford the drugs, estimated that for any person diagnosed with HIV, over their lifetime, the drug might cost $500,000.
Right. Pretty expensive. And what about a vaccine for AIDS?
Well, that's been very difficult to accomplish. And the reason why is because this AIDS virus integrates within your DNA. That is, it becomes part of your DNA. So that you can't give a live virus vaccine, what we call an attenuated or weakened live virus, because it gets inside of you and it replicates forever. We now know a great deal about about HIV, and we now know that once you get infected with these viruses that cause a persistent infection, that the viruses are very smart, and they induce certain factors from you, from the host, to make these factors that cause suppression of your immune response, so that the virus then trains your own system to suppress your own immune response, so you can't really fight the virus very well. We've identified some of those factors. I mean, they have names like IL-10 and PD-1, et cetera. And if you neutralize those, at least in experiments, it hasn't really, for AIDS, it's only been done in the test tube, but it's been done in the whole animal for other persistent infections, you can reverse and really resurrect the cells you need to fight the virus and get rid of the virus. So we are learning a lot of doing things, and there's hope that, but it will take time, you know. I mean, it took the poliomyelitis vaccine about 40 to 50 years before we had a vaccine. So
it takes time.
Well, yes, but we have so much technical resources now and are pushing so hard. Hopefully, it'll go faster.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Oldstone. Excuse me. He is the author of Viruses, Plagues, and History. If you would like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The letter to the editor in the Columbus Dispatch this morning that we were talking about earlier was written by a physician, which makes it even scarier to a lot of people. And this resistance by healthcare providers isn't particularly new, in recent history at least. In 2001, after the Bush administration expanded the manufacture of smallpox vaccine to revaccinate healthcare providers, many resisted then. And you wrote about that. Their arguments were that 20% can't be vaccinated because of pre-existing conditions. And there were other arguments against it, sort of the same ones as today. Well, what is this about? If they understand the herd immunity issue, then...
Well, the smallpox is a little different. There, okay. You know, there nothing's that right or wrong. The problem with the revaccination about smallpox is, once again, if you did get smallpox, about a third of the people would die. Smallpox in the United States stopped in the 1970s. So, if you're born after 1970, which the majority of the population is, and smallpox occurred, and you were infected, you'd expect one-third of the people infected would die from smallpox. The problem is that the virus goes better in immunosuppressed people. We now have large industries, you know, that people take a lot of steroids, and they take steroids and creams and things like that. So we have more susceptible people around. And so the calculation was made by some that if there was a smallpox outbreak, that... they would vaccinate around the outbreak, and they would just take the loss of 20,000 people, and that loss of 20,000 people would be preferable to vaccination. No, I don't particularly believe that, mm-hmm. If I had the opportunity, I would certainly vaccinate my grandchildren and my children who haven't got smallpox vaccines, but that debate's a little different.
You know, some folks have said that they're concerned about the H1N1 vaccine being produced outside the United States. Aren't most vaccines produced outside of the United States now?
Well, some of them are, but and some are not. But I think that you have safety checks on the vaccine, so that should not be a problem. You're not talking about the politics of a third world country making a vaccine that they're going to sell to the United States. I think the vaccines are well controlled and will be a high safety record with them. There's no question that people who took the vaccine or didn't take the vaccine will have some heart attacks and will have some emphysema problems and will have some Guillain-Barré. And perhaps there might be a slight increase in Guillain-Barré, though I'm not sure about that at all. so that you know, as I pointed out before, it's a benefit risk ratio, and the benefits are so high that I think it's foolhardy not to get vaccinated.
There was a case of a measles outbreak in Indiana in 1996, and as I was reading your account of it, it did jog my memory. It was very interesting. Can you explain what happened there and why it's significant?
Well, you shouldn't have. First of all, measles can be a very infectious disease. So if you had 100 people in a room that had never been exposed to measles and measles was in the room, you get about 98 of those 100 people would be infected. So it's one of the most infectious viruses we know. Second of all, it can cause a severe brain infection, which leads to mental retardation and a lot of difficulties, which people have to be institutionalized. So it's something you really are concerned about and taking care of, besides the usual being sick and away from school for 2 weeks and difficulties with that. So vaccine is mandatory in most states, and you really can't go to school unless you get vaccinated or to college unless you're vaccinated. But a lot of states have home care in which homeschooling. If you homeschool, you can avoid doing it. Well, there was a group of I forgot exactly what, a Christian sect that didn't believe in vaccination, and they didn't vaccinate within this community in Indiana. And these were people who were, I would say, middle class, upper middle class, and so they should have known better. But their faith was that they didn't need to be vaccinated. They did a lot of charity work, and what they did was that one of the members of their congregation went to Romania to help with Romanian orphans. And this will also go back to your listener who asked about Ebola. Mm-hmm. The student who came as a missionary worked among orphanages. She then contracted measles, which was endemic in Romania. And she didn't show any symptoms. It takes about 10 to 12 days after you're infected before you break out with measles. She got on a plane, and she came back to her congregation, and she then talked about the good work she did, which was good work in terms of working in an orphanage and helping people out. But while she was giving her talk at that time, she became infectious with measles, and people became infected in the congregation, and those people who left to different parts of the community spread the virus around, and wound up with a number of people being infected, an outbreak in Indiana, and a number of people being hospitalized. Some people, of course, who weren't in the congregation might have been in janitorial service or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem with people who don't vaccinate. They put themselves at a risk. They also put others at a risk. We had the same thing in San Diego with a group of moms who didn't want to vaccinate, and their children got sick. And when they got sick, they came to the doctor's office. There are other children in the doctor's office who are either too young to be vaccinated or hadn't been vaccinated, and measles spread. And it spread on in the doctor's office. It spread on the plane going to Hawaii for vacation. So those are unnecessary things that put people at high risk.
Daniel, you're on the air. You want to talk about vaccinations for toddlers?
Yeah, I wanted to understand some. Actually, it's newborns. I'm actually thinking about
the
logic behind, for instance, a polio vaccination and a couple of vaccinations that we have to stop spread of things that have already kind of been eradicated in this country.
Like diphtheria and that sort of thing?
Correct.
Okay.
And I'm trying to understand the logic behind the speed of which, of where we have some of the schedules from, I don't know if it's from the CDC or if it's from our state, to vaccinate prior to, you know, being able to see milestones in children and be able to understand if something is going awry because of something, you know, they wanted to do different vaccinations to my child prior to, you know, her, you know, before she could even lift up her head.
Is that what that's what you're talking about when you say a milestone?
Yes.
Okay,
like milestones in children's development.
Right. Okay.
And I'm not an anti-vaccination person, but when I try to push back on some of the schedules, mm-hmm. as opposed to the pushing back on the vaccination itself, you know, we got kicked out of our out of our pediatrician practice. Not only the child that we were trying to slow down the schedule, but all of our other children who already were vaccinated, and that pediatrician happened to be a general practitioner, and so he kicked me out too.
Feeling rejected, huh?
Yeah.
That's a good question, Danielle. What about those, Dr. Oldstone, what about these schedules that we've all experienced, those of us who have children?
Well, that's a very good question, Daniel. And I'm sorry that this wasn't explained to you. Actually, there are committees made up of the American Academy of Pediatricians and the CDC and other health organizations that evaluate when different vaccines should be given to give the best protection, and they come to a consensus. They're experts in the field, and they then make their recommendation. It really depends on the vaccine. So let me give you an example. You don't vaccinate people against measles until they're about at least over 6 months of age, usually about 9 months to 12 months of age. And that's because the mother has, if the mother has immunity to a measles virus, then and the baby's being nursed, then the baby gets antibodies from the mother. That is the protective protein that prevents the virus. And so, when you give the vaccine, you block you block its effect because you already have protection from the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that protection only lasts for about 12 months or so, and then it disappears. So there's a period when the baby becomes susceptible. So then they pick that time point when the antibody from the mother would have completely disappeared from the baby that's nursing to give the baby the vaccine. On the other hand, there are babies that shortly after birth become susceptible to certain viral infections, and the virus is present at that time, and so they vaccinate at earlier times. So those schedules have been determined based on knowledge of when is the best time to give the vaccine to protect your child.
Okay. Hey, Dan, did you ever find a practice that would take your kids?
Yes, we did. And okay. I'm just wanting to understand why it's so problematic to divert from the canon.
I didn't understand the question. What did you say, Dan?
I'm trying to understand why it would be so problematic to divert from the canon.
To be different, to decide that you don't want to have your kids be vaccinated so soon. We just have about a minute to go.
At a time, yeah.
Yeah.
The times that we schedule.
Okay. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Well, Dan, I would say it's because you would pose a risk. Your children would pose a risk to other children if they become infected.
The herd. We're just about out of time. I have been speaking with Dr. Michael Oldstone. He is the author of Viruses, Plagues, and History. Very interesting. Appreciate your time today, Dr. Oldstone.
Thank you, Ann.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.